members and the honorable minister and deputy minister. We are proceeding from where we have left. We had left where we needed to proceed with the financials of the department. Can we proceed with that presentation? Over to you, Minister.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Minister. I'm going to be presenting the budget for the Department of Home Affairs. If we just on slide two, I'm just giving a background of what this budget based on. You know, so we as we are aware that the government has committed to remain within an expenditure ceiling. The Home Affairs Department is doing the same. Of importance to note is that the budget over the next 3 years has been cut by 5% in the coming financial year, 6% in 21-22, and 7% in 22-23. So that's going to be putting strain on the department to be able to deliver its services. And added to that, which has been discussed in the previous presentation, is also the ceiling on the compensation of employees that has been imposed by the National Treasury. On slide three, we are just showing the performance of the department versus the expenditure as at 31 March 2019. The department was allocated 9 billion, and we spent the full allocation that was allocated to the department with a savings of 200,000, which represents about 0.002% of the budget, meaning we've spent the full budget that was allocated to the department. Going forward to the next financial year and the two outer years, the department has then been allocated 8.3 billion, and in 2021 8.7, and in 2021-22 9.6 billion to be able to perform its activities. But of importance to note is the line at the bottom of the slide, which indicates the reductions that have been imposed by the National Treasury. So in the next financial year, the budget is going to be reducing by about 193 million rands. And on slide number five, we then go through the summary of the department in terms of programs. So at the top there, with the 9 billion, we split it according to all the programs. So for instance, under administration, that's where we have all the support departments. And within that, we've been allocated 2.3 billion. For citizen affairs is 4.7 billion. And for immigration affairs is 1.2 billion. Then below that, we then turn the numbers around and present them in the economic classification. But of importance to note them is that line, that line from the bottom, which is transfers and subsidies. That 2.1 billion is money that gets transferred to the IEC. So the Department of Home Affairs acts as a conduit where the money comes through, and we immediately transfer that money to the IEC for them to perform their activities. Slide number six, we then go into detail on the program one, which is administration, where all the support departments sit. And then in 1920, we've been allocated 2.3 billion for those activities. On program two, which is civic services, they've been allocated 4.7 billion for the activities. Again, the money that gets transferred to IEC is indicated from the third line from the bottom, those transfers and subsidies. So in the next financial year, 1920, 2.1 billion will be transferred to the IEC, as I've already mentioned. But that money then sits under civic services, and then it gets transferred directly to the IEC for their activities. Immigration affairs, they've got an allocation of 1.2 billion for their activities. I think of importance on the last slide, the chairperson, is the issue around the ceiling on compensation of employees. The department in the next coming financial year cannot exceed that 3.5 billion in terms of the compensation for employees, except in also in 2021 3.8 and in 2022 4 billion. Percentage wise, those increases are around about 3%. In fact, the 3.5 billion is 3% above what the allocation that we got in the previous financial year. So if the salary increases are above the 3%, then the department will breach that ceiling. And the only way to not breach the ceiling is not to fill positions as they become vacant. You know, so that's the only way that you can manage that. And in fact, we've been managing it in that manner. If you recall, on slide number 9 in the previous presentation, where we presented those vacancies arise out of the ceiling that has been imposed by the National Treasurer. Hence, we're unable to fill all the other positions that we need to fill. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Minister? We're okay?
No, I'm okay.
Members?
If you don't, Chairperson, can I speak?
Yes. Then Honorable JJ will follow.
Don't fill vacancies, Minister. Does that not jeopardize, your performance, delivery, and, I listened to you saying something about labor earlier on, workers not working on Saturdays. I mean, I've experienced that on Saturday, on one weekend where we were campaigning in Mpumalanga. And we met with, home affairs workers who were simply saying, look, we're not going to work on weekends anymore. I mean, when this thing was starting. Now, it's a reality. So you are saying that when a vacancy, is declared or when it arises, then you don't feel it because you're trying to balance your purse. Have we gotten to that stage where you no longer care about the service? You want to always, check and balance the amounts. I know. I mean, you don't print money. You have to go to treasury and all those things. But essentially, you can't operate and you can't deliver the best that you or you can't meet your targets. The other thing is, you can't say then. Earlier, you say that. You want to make the Home Affairs, an essential service that workers must work regardless, like police and so on. Is there no other way to look at workers differently and to engage them differently? Because I think, we need to accede to their demands. I know this is not may not be your role to play, but I don't think that should be the approach. It's like forcing someone to be patriotic, but the reality is that people are not happy in the department and there's something that must happen. So it's so saying to people you have to work on legally making it, or forcing people to work, I don't think that's the answer. I think there's other things that we need to look at. We can't simply say by law you're forced to work whether you like it or not, comply and complain later. It's not the approach that I would think that we should take. But I'm more interested in the part where you say you don't want to fill vacancies.
Honorable Maki.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I was just checking on what do we mean when we say unfunded posts. Does it mean that there are people already in those posts, but there's no budget for them? Or are we saying these are the vacant posts? Because if you check, then it means these are vacant posts, they are more than half of what is needed. And if we are going to have budget cuts each and every year, it's going to take us a million years to reduce this. The only solution to the problem would be to up the IT, which will make people unemployed. So in such a situation, I always ask our Treasury, how does Treasury come to a situation of saying this is the how much that you must cut? Is it thumbsack, or what actually happens? Because if you look at these figures, it means there will be no work done. I mean, if we need to sort out the problems within the department with this situation, I don't see how we are going to do it. So I think the minister must talk to the other minister, person to person. And I've never seen it working at any point in time. If I was to give an example, in defense, the department was saying if there's a budget cut, then we won't be able to send a battalion to DRC. Besides the fact that the battalions must exchange after 6 months and so on. So I was just wondering, or then, and I think that is part of the job of this committee to try and sort out this type of a situation. And how do we do it as the portfolio committee and the department? Does it mean that they must reduce their targets? Because that is the only solution that I can think of. Because they can't put the targets that they can't reach. So, all in all, I think I'm talking to myself. Because I don't think they can answer the questions that I'm asking. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honorable Minister.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like very much to fill all the vacancies that need to be filled. It's not by our choice that the situation arises. Many of you honorable members might have been there. If those of you who were in the fifth administration, when the Minister of Finance read the budget, these things were said there, yes, during the budget exercise, that for the budget to be credible, etc., there ought to be a ceiling. And I'm sure you are aware that and many political parties have actually mentioned it, that the state, is busting the ceiling in terms of compensation for employees. That is the highest ever. At 35% of the total budget, and the Minister of Public Service and Administration has even offered, as you know, early retirement packages. But Treasury literally writes to you and say they cut this much. Look at the background there. Baseline cuts over the MTF. 2020-2021, 5% cut. 2021-2022, 6% cut. 2020, So when they cut, what do you do as a department? I would like to fill all the positions, but with the budget cut, I can't. And it will be foolhardy to go to the minister and talk to him individually. I've already tried that, by the way, when I was in health. I was being insulted left, right, center about nurses who have qualified who could not get jobs. But there were budget cuts. You simply don't have money to do so. And we don't control the pest streams. They are controlled by Treasury. And once they say, this is what must happen, and even read it in Parliament for that matter, what do we do as a department? Because these things are not secrets. They were stated there during the budget process, and reasons were given why this is being done. Now, as to whether a department will totally collapse because of that or not, reach its target. Yes, I agree that might be the case, but then it means us as department have to sit down to see how you can do more with very little. It ought to be possible. You look within yourself and say what is more essential, what is more important, what can I do? The issue of, we are not forcing any, when you say a service is essential, it's not to force a worker to do work without their wish. It's a reality of life that certain services are essential. And the easiest example I can give is in health, because I know I'm a doctor. If they tell me that you are essential service, you can't go on strike or you cannot be absent, people will die. So it's not my choice. It's just the way it is. If we sell nurses that you are essential service, you know security forces are essential services. Policemen, it has always been like that. And the army, they've always been. Now, the acting DG here, Ndate Mekhi, mentioned that we are looking at home affairs, and it belongs to that cluster. The justice, security, yeah, it's a security department. Now we are mentioning about establishing a border management authority, which must deal with our borders. The borders are always there for 24 hours. You then cannot say, no, the border management authority will only be active between 8 and 4. The border is alive for 24 hours. And so when you are talking about essential services, you are mentioning things like that. If you are in a security, we can't say during this hour security is not wanted. It's dangerous for the country. And that's what we are discussing with the unions. And many of them are starting to understand it. Otherwise, we must then keep quiet about the issues of security if we can't do something like that. But, Chairperson, the issue of budget cuts are a reality that all of us don't enjoy. But we are faced with that, unfortunately.
Can I not hear that all want to? Otherwise, IAC must come closer. Honorable Pambo and Honorable Maki will follow. But the IAC, you can proceed. The IAC can set up now.
Okay, Minister. Look, I note the limitation, or the limitation that you're faced with in as far as the budget is concerned. On the question of essential services, the response in making Home Affairs, workers essential, or to be categorized as essential workers, does not arise from the emergency or the possibility of someone dying or their security. It's arising here precisely because there is trouble with labor in that department, I would like to think. It doesn't arise because there is a life and death situation. It arises because of labor-related matters, I would like to think, unless you're going to tell me differently. And so I was saying, is that the only solution? I'm not opposed to it being that. I do think that it's something that ought to be there. But I'm also interested in, the thinking behind it. It cannot be that for every problem we have, we move towards that approach of essentializing. Chairperson, I think this movement that you have now sanctioned is highly destructive. Can people sit down and we speak properly? Because now we are watching people moving around. It's not fair. Thinking is not an easy thing. So that is where the question arises from, Minister. The other thing is, sitting here, I'm looking at your department, and I think it's quite problematic to see the faces that I see. And I say this with all sort of pain. I see a lot of men, Minister, and I think you must do something about that. Some men must fall here. We want to see more women. This does not reflect the demographic or the approach by the minister, by the president, to say he's got 50-50 gender parity. No, it's not working. So, Minister, you must do something about it, even if it takes you 3 years. But we want to see more women being employed here, particularly young people. And it's not personal. I'm just saying that is something that we want to see in this situation that we're faced with. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm still on the same point that I'm just thinking that if the department is going to lower the targets in an essential department like this one, because there's no way in which we are going to judge them in something that they can't implement. So I was just saying it will be that wouldn't be the right thing to do. I mean, it's a catch-21 situation. They need more funds. The funds are being cut. The question is, are they going to lower their targets? Because they can't come here and tell us they are going to do this if they can't. Then it means the target must be lowered. And that is not what we are looking forward to. Thank you.
Yes. Chairperson, let me correct. The first thing, we are not making Home Affairs an essential service. We never said so. Because Home Affairs is huge, it has got many sectors. We are talking about specific group of workers who do a specific work, especially on immigration, because we are saying that is a security part also about what happens at the borders. It's not everybody. Our discussion with unions is not to say the whole Home Affairs issue must be essential. Even in the other departments which have got essential services, it's not every worker. It's specific people who do a specific job, because if they are there, then there will be chaos. There will be a problem. Society will actually be severely disadvantaged. That's the one that we're talking about. The issue of cutting our targets is that what we are doing, Chairperson, when we revise these APPs, we try to do them according to the money that we are given. Obviously, it's true. If there was more money, we could have been having higher targets. But the target we choose, it's in terms of what you are having. You are cutting the clothes, I mean the suit, in terms of the size of the cloth that we have got. That's what we are doing at the present moment. For instance, I have just mentioned this morning that out of the 412 offices, 193 are modernized offices with equipment, with everything. One will have left to increase the number of offices like that. We are going to increase this financial year from 193 to about 200. Obviously, you increase in terms of what you have. You can't increase beyond what you have, because then resources are always limited, and that's the situation we're faced with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairperson, the question of gender, I think the minister must say something about it.
Don't have to contest that one. It's the aim of each and every department to move towards gender parity. What we'll then do is to look at the whole SMS. And that's what the government departments have been asked to do, by the way, even by cabinet, that when you appoint every person at the SMS level, you show the gender, you actually show it to cabinet and say, this is the gender, equation. After appointing this person, this is what it looked like. It's something that we all with it. Meaning, out of the vacancies that I've mentioned, I only mentioned the acting for the executive, which is up to TDG. I never went to chief director or director. But when you go to appoint, the cabinet is going to ask me the same question that you are asking me. It's not something that needs to be debated. They are going to ask me, why is there no gender parity at the moment? And I'll have to answer to that and do something about it. So there's no argument with you. In other words, we are in full agreement that something ought to be done.
Thank you, Honorable Minister. Can we take the presentation and the briefing from the IEC? You don't need to move, Honorable. DM. I was saying advantage that you are new. You think I'm chasing you away, but okay. On your time, man. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Advocate Bongo, and congratulations to your appointment to the position of the chair. Honorable Minister Zwaledi, Deputy Minister Nzuza, and honorable members of the Home Affairs Portfolio, allow me to take this opportunity to thank all the political parties that are represented here and the parties that contested the national provincial elections 2019. And also to congratulate all those of you who were successful in our last elections. On behalf of the Electoral Commission, let me thank you for having provided us this opportunity to come and brief this committee on our strategic plans and our annual performance plans for the coming financial year. As the constitutional body, Chapter 9 institution, it is both our privilege and our duty to report to yourselves as elected representatives of the people on our strategic objectives and plans, as well as how we will set out to achieve those objectives over the coming year. And honorable members, allow me to apologize that our commission could not all be fully represented here. The vice chairperson is currently out of the country, and the other commissioner, Dr. Masogo, is on leave after the grueling elections, as well as Judge Pillay, who is a part-time commissioner due to prior court duties, was not able to join us and catching up with the backlog back in the province that they are responsible. Similarly, our CEO has taken leave, is on vacation, but fortunately Commissioner Miepia and myself were able to reschedule to be in a position to be present here today. I am, as already introduced, accompanied by our acting Chief Electoral Officer that the Shibori, together with the other administrative staff. I won't go into their names, they've already been introduced. But
Mr. Shiburu will take us through the plan, but before I hand over to him, I would like just to make a few remarks that set the context of the coming financial year for us as a commission. Honourable members, this financial year is without doubt one of our busiest and the most challenging in terms of our activities in the last 21 years as an institution. Over the next 12 months, the Commission must achieve, among others, the following things. We have to finalize our efforts to update the voters' roll with the address particulars of all the voters in accordance with the ruling of the Constitutional Court. And we have to also file our final report with the Constitutional Court November this year. We need also to initiate the planning for the 2021 local government elections. We normally require a time frame of around 24 months in planning for the elections. So this year is very critical in setting up that baseline plans and budgeting. Further, we also have to prepare the implementation of the new political party funding legislation. As we recall, it was deferred, and we have to now embark on that so that it is operational by the time we get into our local government election. Further, we also are in a period where our long-term plans are needed to be adapted and adjusted to the changing landscape, especially in the electoral area we're in, and incorporate the much-needed technology renewals, as well as update and enhance the platforms and systems that are required to continue in ushering uncontested electoral results. And we would also in that require to replace the voter registration platform. And the other thing that is ahead of us is implementing an organizational renewal and review and to reconfigure our institution for the new landscape as far as the elections are concerned. So it is at a period where we're making those adaptations. And also our strategic plan is due for renewal. Our strat plan ended up 2018, so we had deferred until we finished with the elections to do the next round of 5 and 10 year plans. So, honourable members, the implementation of all of these things invariably is going to require and take a considerable amount of challenge and work on the part of the organization. But also, it also means at the same time, we as an institution are not operating in vacuum. And for us to be able to then deliver the free and fair elections, we would have a lot of work to be done in partnership with certain critical departments, among them the Home Affairs, especially whom we rely with the issue of the identities of the voters, as well as the Department of Local Government, COCTA. We as the Commission, we will not rest until we can live up to our constitutional obligations. And we hope then that in that partnership, we should be in a position to assure the country that between us and the key strategic stakeholders within the state environment, we will continue the delivery of our elections as we've done in the last five administrations. And we also like to express our appreciation and gratitude to the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs that in all our activities in the past, we have depended and relied on the guidance, the robust engagement, and the support of the department in ensuring that we meet these obligations. We're looking also forward that this period you will be also joining with us as the Portfolio Committee in finalizing a number of things. Among them, it would include approval of draft legislative amendments. And also in assisting in ensuring that we do get the necessary resources that are required to meet our constitutional and legislative mandates. And working together as represented political parties in a cooperative spirit will, as always, will ensure a climate conducive for us to deliver free and fair elections. Yeah. Honorable Chair, may I then take the opportunity to invite my colleague, the acting CEO, if he can now proceed and take us through the high level of the strategic plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson of the Commission, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Minister and Deputy Minister. The structure of the presentation is twofold. One is to share information with members of the committee so that we have a background of what the IEC is and what it does. But secondly, and more pertinently, is to highlight the salient aspects that we require, that require the cognizance of the committee in the immediate and in the short and medium, and in the short and medium term. The slides in the initial part of the presentation remain the same. The legal environment has not changed, so our mandate, our vision has not changed. So I propose that we spend a few minutes reflecting on the environmental analysis and the key challenges, and then that will inform the choices that we needed to do when we present the strategic plan and the budget. The legal mandate of the Electoral Commission, as I said, has not changed. But what the committee should be aware of are the following on these slides. Mandate number B and E. These are key in the context of local government elections and by-elections, given that an address has now gained prominence. It's almost like a condition precedent to free and fair elections. So the work that we'll be doing is aimed at improving the voter's role so that it is fit for purpose for local and for local government elections. Similarly, on this slide, legislative mandate number N. This is an area of rapid development and where there's a significant growth in jurisprudence. Linked to the work that we do here is the requirement on our part to improve the capacity so that we can give effect to the recourse that is in our scheme of law as it relates to electoral justice, the ability to deal with complaints, and the ability to resolve electoral offences that are raised with the Electoral Commission. The Chairperson has referenced the Constitutional Court judgment in Mhlophe. It asked two things of us. The first is that the Commission must, by November this year, have updated the voters' roll with the addresses of all voters who were registered by 17 December 2003. Secondly, that in doing so, we must establish a nexus between an address and a ward in which a person is registered. So the first one is to update addresses, but as you update addresses, there must be a nexus between an address and a ward in which that person is registered so that a voter cannot impact the outcome of a result in a ward in which they have no business or they are not ordinarily resident. I'll skip this other slide. The chairperson has referenced them. The funding shortage is a perennial challenge for all of us in the public service. And the things that we need to do imminently, and this I repeat because these are the things that arise out of our national debrief following the conduct of the general elections on the 8th of May. The first is to invest in the deployment of technology to improve our registration performance so that at the point of contact with a voter, we can create a link between a voter and locate them in a ward segment in which they are registered. Secondly, is to deploy technology to facilitate real-time live voters' role to obviate accusations of multiple and double voting so that when a person's ID is scanned at a voting station and we issue them with ballots, we can also mark them on a central database that they have that they voted so that we obviate accusations that people voted at one point and later on presented themselves at another station for purposes of voting. The third point relates to the use of social media. Social media can be an enabler and a facilitator of information dissemination, but it can also be, it can also have deleterious effects to the outcome and conduct of an election. So we need to bolster our capability to counter misinformation that is peddled on social media. I just pause on the last bullet point on this slide just to underscore the point that the chairperson made, and that is following the national debrief after the elections this year, there's a number of immediate actions that we must take, and those must be funded. We will have occasion to debrief with political parties and then go into a strategic session in August, after which we may approach Parliament and the Portfolio Committee to adjust our strategic plan so that we are enabled to take serious decisions that will impact in the 2021 elections and going forward into the 2024 national and provincial elections. We have three strategic goals that are incubated in three programs, Program 1, Program 2, and Program 3. I'll start with Program 1. The strategic objectives in Program 1 are mainly those that implicate internal arrangements and are inward-looking and are largely of a compliance nature. Going forward, this is an area where we could better improve and sharpen the strategic goals so that we can demonstrate the impact much better. The first goal deals with the number of commission meetings, and we have an annual target of 11. The second deals with the number of quarterly reports that the CEO has reviewed and approved. This is 4, and those are largely statutory and compliance matters. The number of quarterly internal audit progress reports, these are 4, largely compliance-driven. Quarterly review and update the Electoral Commission strategic risk register by the Executive Risk Management Committee. These are largely governance matters that we must do. The number of permanent positions that we have, we currently have 900 field posts out of our organogram, and that translates into 90%. In the immediate term, we hope that we will fill the organogram to respond to the organizational review that will conclude sometime in August. Consistent with other state institutions, we are not in a position to breach the remuneration ceiling, and therefore we're going to have to make hard choice decisions on whether the new structure as approved is affordable or whether we could implement it in a phased approach. The 1.3.2 deals with the number of permanent staff that are provided with developmental training interventions. This is 180 per annum, and the targets are spread over the 4 quarters. The last one on the slide deals with performance management, which is also largely a compliance-driven target. 1.4 deals with an outward thing that gives us assurance. to achieve an unqualified audit report on the annual financial statements in each year. The AG is about to conclude the work that they do on our books, and this we will report to in the forthcoming meetings of the committee. The next slide deals with how we measure our uptime as it relates to our network and our availability of services on our network. We hold ourselves to 97% uptime on our network so that we do not lose productivity time, and we want to achieve 97% for each of the quarters. The chairperson has referenced the necessary upgrade to IT hardware, and this we have already begun on platform upgrade that we implemented just before the elections, and the rest of the work will be ongoing in this year and also in the MTF, if so funded. The second strategic goals relates to the work that we do in the what you could call the core business of the Electoral Commission. This impacts on the voter and on political parties. And the key strategic objectives there are to manage free and fair elections in accordance with the applicable electoral timetables, to maintain an accurate national common voters' role, and we come back to this point one over and over again because this is at the heart of the work that we must do in preparing for 2021 elections. Ensure efficient election delivery. This relates to the infrastructure and the logistics that we put in place for each of the elections that we manage. The first target here relates to the average number of calendar days in which elections are conducted from the date of a vacancy. We all know that all legislative body vacancies must be filled within 90 days of those vacancies occurring. So if whether it is a dissolved municipal council, we must run those elections within 90 days. Whether it's a by-election, we must run those elections within 90 days. In the first quarter, we met the target by conducting the national and provincial elections in the 90-day period that was stipulated in the Constitution. So over the remaining three quarters, we'll judge ourselves against the conduct as it relates to municipal by-election. The 2.1.2 is the same matter, but this one implicates the proportional representative councillors. And there we have a statutory obligation to fill those vacancies within 35 days. Currently, we do this in 12 days. The next target, 2.1.3, relates to the number of days in which we release results of an election. Statutory, we must do it in 7 days. We've always been able to do this within 3 days, and for by-elections, we do it within a day. 2.1.4, I pause here for a few seconds, because in the last financial year, we have had 2 by-elections set aside by the Electoral Court, because it was established that there were deficiencies on the voters' roll, and those deficiencies imperiled the freeness and fairness of an election. Increasingly, political parties wait until the last moment to object. You have a by-election, they lose, and then they draw a copy of the voters' roll to demonstrate that there are persons who are registered on that segment who ought not to have been registered on that segment, and for that reason they approach the Electoral Court, and the Electoral Court is more than happy to set those by-election aside. We, however, even with this knowledge, however, set ourselves to a higher standard that we target that no by-election should be set aside on the basis of the voters' roll or any failure on our part to comply with the legal prescripts. 2.2.1 relates to the number of registered voters reflected on the voters' roll as at the 31st of March each year. This is a debate that is raging in the organization. Similarly to voter turnout and similarly to the number of spoiled ballots as to whether is this a function of an election management body or this is a function of other state actors or political parties or a combination. For now, we hold ourselves to impact on the turnout of voters. We hold ourselves accountable on the registration figures on the ballot paper. We also hold ourselves accountable for the number or instances of spoiled ballots, even though we know that an election process is not the only contributor to those three indicators. 2.2.2, here we aim to reduce the number of registered voters who appeared on the voters' roll as of the 31st of March 2016 for whom the Electoral Commission does not have an address or sufficient particularities. When the court made its judgment in 2016, we had in excess of 24 million people registered on the voters' roll, and we only had addresses for about 8 million South Africans, or 34% of persons who were registered. Fast forward to May 2019, we have improved the address situation to 85% or 22 million people who appear on the voters' roll who have an address. By the end of this financial year, our target is that there should not be more than 1.3 million people who appear on the voters' roll for whom we do not have a full address. This slide relates to the number of voting stations that we employ for elections, and in the absence of elections, the number of voting stations that we activate for by-elections. The slide talks to the number of liaison sessions that we have with political parties, and this is something that we've been able to export to the rest of the continent and internationally. All observer missions are fascinated by the structured manner that we have of maintaining liaison with political parties, because it is something that is not common in other jurisdictions. So for this financial year, we will have 1,338 liaison sessions with political parties. They could deal with substantive things like the demarcation of wards and the subsequent delimitation of voting district. We could discuss issues like legislative amendments that are necessary in the preparation for local government elections in 2021. And these liaison sessions are maintained at national across the nine provinces and in all of our local municipalities. For this year, the number of recruited electoral staff was 208, and this was in the first quarter, and this has been done with. The last strategic goal, Chair, deals with an area related to the work that we do in outreach, the work that we do to strengthen electoral democracy. This is, by its nature, outward-looking, and it is correctly so an area that has received the greatest attention during our debriefing session. At a structural level, the question that we raised among ourselves as colleagues was whether, is it the function of an election management body to encourage electorates to participate in an election? Or is it the function of the political choices that citizens have? Going into this election and consistent with all other elections, the number of parties has increased from 29 in 2014 to 48 political parties on the national ballot in 2019. However, of all those parties, the voters who are the ultimate arbiters have repudiated the claims of all but 14 political parties, which means we have one more party than we had in all other elections, meaning the representation in Parliament has plateaued at 13 political parties. It has just increased by one out of this election. There it calls for two things: whether the regime of registering political parties is still adequate. Secondly, whether deposit as a mechanism to facilitate participation are still adequate or require a change. Those are the things that we'll discuss in the context of legislative amendments ahead of local government election. In 2 minutes, I will be done, Chair. 3.1.1. Number of voters who turn out in national and local government elections as a percentage of registered voters in years when applicable. In the last election of national and provincial elections, the voter turnout was about 75.8%. We've held ourselves to a voter turnout of 70%. We know that we've only been able to register voter turnout of 66%. The number of civic and democracy education events held per annum, these are the number of face-to-face interactions that we have with communities, with voters, with citizens, to encourage them to be to remain connected and invested in democracy as a form of governance. We've targeted 15,000 interventions for this financial year. Again, we also have a disaggregated target that talks to how we track the efficacy of our civic and democracy education that we do over community radio, that we do over radio stations and on TV. We had set out to target or reach 5 million people, and we use the source that we indicator that we receive from radio station on the viewerships and to or from radio stations on the listenerships. And for this financial year, we have reached almost 5 million people, 3 on radio and 2 million over the TV, various TV platforms that we activated. The point 3.1.4 deals with public perceptions of Electoral Commission as evidenced by the media reports for each year covered by the annual performance plan. In this regard, we even go beyond just media reports. We commission the Human Science Research Council to do an independent study on voting day. They interact with the voting public, a person who's just had contact with an IEC through the only prism that matters, which is a voting station. They interview them, and from there we get ratings. The perceptions of freeness and fairness remains high as at 92%, even for these elections. The last point here deals with the number of recorded spoiled ballots in national and local government elections. We had a target of 1.85 as because that represents an international norm of voter spoiled ballots. And even with the most difficult ballot paper that we had for the first time in this election, the number of spoiled ballots has not increased. In fact, we've recorded a marginal decline, meaning that the ballot paper, even with 48 parties, it was still usable to enable a voter to make a choice properly, because they could identify the identifiers of their political party on the ballot paper. The last point relates to research and thought leadership initiatives that we plan for this year. For this year, we've committed to having 4 leadership and thought leadership processes. The chairperson, with your indulgence, I'd ask the CFO to go through the budget in the immediate term and to also indicate the budget for the MTF.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Should I operate for you?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Thank you. So one of the main, before we actually get to the budget, we thought we should just highlight one of the key cost drivers, which is around the LGE, which is a local general election in 2021. So one of the key cost drivers that we have is the online registration, which we want to go to. But the main issue with that is that we're looking at a shortfall of about 300 million. And we are in discussion with National Treasury. The objective of the new online registration is to actually repair the outdated ZipZip machines that we currently have. Secondly, with regards to also another cost driver, we are also looking at 2 registration weekends that are also going to precede the local general election that's coming up in 2021. Next slide. The next slide shows our global view of our expenditure coming from the 3 financial years as well as the MTF. The previous years are audited, and then the subsequent years are then not audited, with those are rich projection for MTF. If you look at our budget, there are 3 main drivers. Those are the 3 programs which the DCO is actually well unpacked to say what are the 3 core programs. The first one relates to administration. The second one relates to our core business, which is the operation for electoral operation. Then the third one is regards to outreach. We can go to the next slide. In looking at our budget, it's very important that when you look at our budget, it's not always straight line. It's always defined and driven by the activity that we will be actually looking at or addressing for that year. For example, if we start and look at 2018-2019, we had one registration for the NPE, and we allocated a budget of $1,963,000,000. That was really to facilitate that year. Then the subsequent year, we have for the subsequent year for the NPE, 2019-2020, that's the NPE year, that budget allocated is $2,052,000,000. The next year is a one registration weekend, as well as one registration for LGE, of which was an allocation of $2 billion. And then the subsequent final year of the NTF is 2020-21-22 is an allocation of $2,429,000,000. Most importantly, if you look at the graphs, the key driver and the significant of the programs actually relates to our electoral operation. That's a significant part of our budget. And I think that's all on my side.
Thank you, Chair. Just in conclusion, the past elections have been the most disruptive elections we've ever organized. And out of that, I think the South African population expects from the Electoral Commission to come up with an emphatic response. This presents that response, albeit underfunded in other areas. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to my colleagues. Honorable members, this now concludes the presentation from the Commission, but perhaps one can just underline the emphasis on the issue of the budget. It is that we now, as the Commission, see that elections will be described as the pre-2019 elections and post-2019 elections, in the sense that the landscape has changed, and we will not survive as a commission and as a country if we do not make radical adjustments in terms of enabling us to deal with the challenges that emerged from these last elections. A simple thing like Home Affairs' innovative move to move us into a smart card has thrown a major check and balance in the system that we used to have with the Green ID book. So there are all these little things that, you know, they come up. And a faulty, defective supplier with the material can throw the country in disarray. Social media, we actually need to find a way of how do we balance, because simple thing like when you have special votes, you take special votes, take place, and at the end of the day, you have to put the ballot boxes, the ballot papers in the box. Somebody takes a photo, and then it comes out and say, you see, the IEC is now busy rigging elections. Or people are voting overseas. As they are stealing that thing, that little photo in the social media can be something else. We have 15 million households in South Africa. Only 8 million of those households have actually a conventional physical address. And now for local government elections, it can actually make a difference, because where a person is registered and where a person votes can actually determine the fate of a municipality. So the sensitivities have become higher, the standards for us to meet are higher, and we are very much prepared as a country, and we are proud of that achievement, and that's what the world is respecting about us. But for us to accomplish that, we need to achieve it with your support and also with the support of our national government. We, even within the conditions that we all are aware in terms of budgetary challenges. And we as a commission, we actually make it clear that we stand ready to continue with this glorious and honorable responsibility that has been entrusted in us and in this institution to carry our country's democracy project forward. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Mashinini. I think I must take this opportunity to thank you as the IEC on behalf of the committee for the sterling work that you have done in ensuring that we arrive where we are in terms of the elections in the country. I'm fully aware that in many countries, because of the IEC-related issues, those countries get plunged into civil wars and other things. So we have managed, despite the issues that we are raising and the budgetary constraints that are there. I think we as the committee would not take very light the work that we have put in and the work that you continue to do in the IEC. And we will pledge our continued support for the work that you do and make sure that we enhance whatever issues that have been raised that came as a result of the smart IDs. I see the minister is speaking very high of it on the other side, and banks. And you at the IEC are raising other issues that about the system, but we were a developmental state, and whenever confronted with challenges, we seek to resolve them. We seek to resolve them in a progressive way, the progressive realization of all the problems that we have. So, members, I'm going to take from yourselves the presentation, but note we have received an apology from the chairperson of the IEC, Mr. Mashinini, that he's actually rushed to Durban. So, I have granted that apology on your behalf, members, because of the nature of the work that is going to do in Durban, which he has discussed with me in confidence. So before he leaves, let's entertain questions or comments with regard to the presentation from the IEC. You want to start? You'll be the first, and then a group will be the second. Honorable Angel will be the third, and then fourth, and then Pambo will be the last. We can take those hands in that order.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine's just a comment, and also to appreciate the work that has been done by the IEC under tight budgetary constraints. I want to venture on the area of security. I think the Chair is trying to highlight that. I think there were few incidents that happened during the phase of the elections. What are the challenges and plans to mitigate those areas of the security measures? I think in Limpopo, there was an area where boxes were just all over of the vote ballot papers. So I think if we can expand on that. And another area of what are the complement contribution that I think the IEC is doing to the staff that may contribute to mistakes when you are doing your the election work on the area of fatigue and so forth and so on. I wanted us to just to expand on that. There was an area, I think, Chairperson, on the budget. I think if you look on the presentation that is made, the committee, I think, need to take a more interest in terms of the limitation of the budget that I think they've been allocated to the committee, which I think will limit to function, to help the IEC to function, looking on the massive work that they've been engaged in the previous elections. And now noting that we're going to a local government election, which is going to be a very contested area in terms of the issues that are coming up on the area. We have also raised the issue of the demarcation challenges that I think we're facing as we go to the local government election. Obviously, certain areas in the country were faced with that challenge, and how I think you may need to expand in terms of the areas where you need the portfolio committee to make submission and assist. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I was actually worried when you said Mr. Shinini want to leave. Now, safe to say that everyone is already on leave, then we're also left with Ntate Mahepe, but I hope he will steer the ship. Chair, when Mr. Mashinini opened, he made a very palatable remark. He said, SN is a constitutional body. They have a constitutional obligation. I really endorse him. I like that. And I'm happy that the minister is here for what I'm going to say now, Minister. Cabinet has approved an interim municipal election team, Cabinet, which consists of ministers and a number of clusters. Now, in the midst of a statement of this institutional constitutional body, you know, and as we, if we say we are independent Section 9 institution, what has informed this decision by Cabinet, and perhaps IEC can respond to this as to whether there was a request from IEC for this interim municipal election task team that really raised the eyebrows. And the IEC have a constitutional mandate, finito, finished, clear. It's non-negotiable. Now, when the IMC is going to operate interministerial committee, well, their functions, will that not be some sort of encroaching, you know, upon the constitutionality of this body? And we cannot allow that the IEC must be a conduit by an interministerial committee. That is the first issue. Then my second issue is the infamous court ruling of David Kam from the Northwest, where I come from, J.B. Marks, on the copies of the voters' roll. I want to know, because I know there was a lot of problems in the past where you have a voters' roll and then you have a copy of a voters' roll. What is going to happen with that voters' roll? Will it be a submission of an authentic voters' roll to other bodies? Then, I like the slide that speaks to the challenges, but one of the biggest challenges with us out there on the ground was the zip-zap machine. Are we going to use new ones? What control or measurements will be put in place in order for us to make sure that people don't vote twice? That is the problem that we have of people voting twice, let alone what has happened now recently in the election. Then, Chair, in terms of the updating of the voters' roll, and I also like the comment that Mr. Mashinini made in terms of that relationship and the innovation on home affairs, and also the minister's word on what is transpiring in home affairs. But I would take it for granted that home affairs must play a pivotal role when it comes to the update of the voters' roll together with the IEC. I'm saying this because, you know, we've seen people who is late, they know more, they have voted. We've seen list that has been taken from a dry cleaner shop, they have voted. That type of things is happening. So we need to know, in terms of the voters' roll, what a wonderful system that the Home Affairs have, what kind of synergy between those two bodies will happen. Then another issue for me, special votes, Mr. Mashinini. It is a given that we have a lot of problems with special votes, and it's completely misused out there. I also want to know what will be done in terms of that. Then I take note of the awareness campaign, involvement of the IEC has been said by Mr. Mahepe, but in the midst of what has happened, and I must say to IEC that they had a wonderful, funky campaign, Exhale, Let's Go Vote. Needless to say, the youth did not come out. So we have to engage in a discussion to see how best are we going to have South Africans out there to vote for us. Then, when you hear every department, when they come to various portfolio committees and do their presentations, it's always, you know, falling off post and. I see on one of the indicators that the IEC says we want to fill vacancies at least 90%. So my question is not why not 100%? Who are we leaving the 10% for? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. The question that I have noticed that in many voter videos, voting districts, the IEC hires the teachers. One cannot overemphasize the issue of unemployment in our country. So my question will be, what is the plan of the IEC to ensure that going forward, seeing that at the presentation that was presented in front of us, they say they hire and train their staff, will they be looking into hiring people who are unemployed, maybe looking at the database of the Department of Employment and Labor? I also saw a reference to voter education. What I'd like to request the IEC is that in the next meeting, can they maybe bring us a report that indicates what was their target in terms of voter registration and if they were able to reach that target. And on their presentation on 3.1.3, it reads as follows: audience reached by civic and democratic education programs through television and radio in each year covered by annual performance plan. What is the plan of IEC to ensure that when they do these programs, outreach programs, they also use social media? Because most of our young people, I'm not sure if they listen to the radio or they watch television, but I do know that they're actively, they're so active on social media. And there were a number of reports that the registration of the young people in the NPE elections was actually very low. So basically it means among 2,000, many of them, they did not vote. And another thing that I have picked up is that in many of the public meetings that we have had while we're campaigning, we have actually picked up that most members of our community do not know about their rights to go and register to vote. And before you actually have to tell them about your manifesto, you must actually educate them why they need to go and register to vote, and then you will then talk about your manifesto. So I don't know if there is a plan or a report or a way to actually quantify that the message is actually getting out there and to the relevant people. Mr. Shivuri also spoke about the scanner. The question that I have is that I want to know that in the current scanning system that was used, why is the scanner was not able to pick up that there are people that have voted already? Because after elections, there were reports and there were a number of arrests that were made of people that actually voted twice. And I remember very well where I voted. When I gave them my ID, they scanned it. So I would have assumed that they have my details, so there's no way I can actually go and vote into another VD because the system will actually pick it up. And there's a point where you also mentioned that looking at the number of the spoiled ballot papers, the number, I'm speaking under correction, remained the same if it did not increase. That's what you exactly said. And I just need your opinion on this. Do you really think that should we have went out and taught our voters about how they need to vote, maybe would have increased the number of spoiled ballot papers? Because as you were talking about the ballot papers where they take screenshots or whatever, we have seen that if maybe they want to vote for the DA, they will vote for the DA, and then maybe on the EFF they write, I love you, and IFP they write whatever. So it simply shows that this person doesn't know how to vote, because maybe they would have assumed that we have made a tick, that's why it's going to be counted as a valid ballot paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on the matter of the VDs, the voting stations. During the national election and the provincial elections, and sometimes in the by-elections, most of the VDs, they are on private property. What measures are the IEC doing in terms of maybe some of the political parties in the private properties, they are not allowed to campaign and all of those things. So what are the measures that the IEC is doing in terms of decreasing those problems? And also on the demarcation board, is the IEC and the demarcation board working together? Because of now we are talking about the voters' role, where in terms of you are taking addresses of each and every individual, that this person is on the voters' roll, maybe of this current ward. But now when the demarcation board is saying that this ward is no longer on this demarcation, is the IEC going to tell those people that you are no longer in this ward, you are now automatically on the other ward? Thank you.
Well, two things before we get into the presentation or lack of some of the issues that were raised. One is that I think the chairperson must not do what he did in accepting the presentation by IEC and pronounce in our name that we congratulate whatever that you were saying, because that is not the spirit in which we have agreed, or we can't pronounce on behalf of all of us like that. I think you must first hear us and hear whether or not we've got a dissenting view, or our behavior or our relationship with IEC may be different from the views that you have just expressed. So I think you must desist from doing such or making such statements on our behalf, especially if you're going to include us in your presentation. To the IEC, I think the issue that I'm raising now, you know about it, Mr. Shiburi. We have written to you, my office in particular, from the EFF, in elections. We have written to you about Section 24A. And in many platforms, in particular here I speak of Business Day, you did express an opinion about the Section 24A and in relation to double voting. We all know that Section 24A... in this regard was at least or come as a result of trying to prevent double voting with the knowledge that the ZipZip machine does not tell us how many people have voted. It just simply says whether or not you are registered. So in that regard, the ZipZip machine cannot assist us in any way. We know that. It's simply a toy. So in the configuration or in the sort of preparations of 2021, we would hope that when you speak about those changes, you are speaking specifically about coming up with or procuring a system that simply tells us whether or not Vuyani Pambo has voted, and which can also tell us how many people have voted, so a live system. A real-time sort of system, but also I'm really concerned because in this presentation you did not flesh out the challenges in a real sense. So you say in that Business Day that you ran out of Section 24A forms. And in the spirit of getting everyone to vote, you then let people to vote without the Section 24A. I think I may find something, and if you want, I can read it verbatim. And so for me, and that's why I'm cautioning the chairperson not to speak so positively about the IEC. I think you have many challenges. As the chair said, we could in the future speak of a post and pre-2019 elections because of the challenges that we faced and some stupidity from some perhaps not so significant political parties in taking advantage of that challenge. So I hear you saying that, you know, there's 92% sort of feeling about, you know, IEC being free and fair. But if we were to be honest and have an open conversation, that IEC is very important to the machinery or to the holding together this thing we call democracy. Because if you collapse that system, especially at the time during elections, you can plunge us into a civil war. So this is not to say that we did not accept the results. We accepted the results, and even when that mayhem was happening at the results center, we were the first to announce that this is not going to happen in our name, in our watch, that political parties may be attempting at something of a civil war. But there isn't a plan, at least from your side, that is at least assuring us, as far as we're reading it, where you are able to say, this is what we're going to do in clear terms. Because you did have a safety measure, which is Section 24A, and that itself was not respected or was not used. In fact, you forewent it. You said, look, in the spirit of having a high voter turnout, you're going to continue voting despite people not having a Section 24A. In the absence of Section 24A, you are unable to account for people who are voting outside of the sort of addresses. So my mother, who comes from the Eastern Cape, to come vote for the EFF in Soweto, in the ward that I reside, can go back to the Eastern Cape and vote again in the absence of a configured a system or a synchronized system wherein you can tell that this person has voted in real time. So that then blocks the person from voting again. It's not that the technology is not there. If the question is, does the IEC have the will? And of course, you may raise the issue of money, but at least give us a plan, give us a system or systems that are there, and then we can then speak from that point as this committee and say, we need this system. But you can't say, you know, we still have to. By now, at least, I don't know, maybe you do have, and that you have not presented that system to us. We need to present it so that when we speak to the minister here and we go to Treasury, which must say or must show importance of that system. But as it stands, it looks like the next elections are going to be chaotic if we go in with the same sort of system that we have now. You know, you have a section. I don't know, man. Maybe I'm too hurt by this, but it's worrying that, and maybe you must respond to this in particular. You have a section that says, or rather, a legislation that says you must make sure that everyone who comes and votes outside of their place of voting or, you know, where they're designated must fill in this form, and you run out of it. Then you take the risk of getting those people to vote without that thing. I'm not going to talk about indelible ink, because that itself was twofold. Both the voters were culprits and IEC to an extent. I mean, as far as they demonstrated, I can't say whether or not it's true. They are participating in removing the ink, which is another safety pin. So we actually essentially have two strong ones. I won't count the scratching out of the ballot box, the ballot paper, the voters' roll rather, at the station, because that is not really a measure, at least in my looking at it. But those two things are things that we can resolve. Perhaps the zip one is expensive and whatever the case may be, but at least present us with a system and say, guys, this is what we want. We want 2 billion, whatever the case may be, but this is going to prevent X, Y, and Z. Because what's the point of having elections, you know, in the same way that we did now, and then we collapse? It means all that money that you're trying to preserve for other things, you're going to have to, you know, solve a civil war, because that's where you are taking us. We can no longer tell supporters that they must not fight IEC. It's heartbreaking for party agents who sit there, guard votes, and see people doing such mischief. I don't want to bring political parties into it, but I'm just simply saying, from a point of achieving a free and fair election and an uncontested outcome, I think those things must be dealt with. And I don't see in the presentation something that goes in detail, you know, in talking to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually wanted to speak on the issue of the indelible ink, and I think my colleague very succinctly articulated the issues. I was one of those people who, straight after voting, I was able to wash off the ink, and I didn't wash my hands, like you would normally wash your hands. So my question is, I saw some reports that the IEC was going to engage the company that provided you with the ink or the pens, and whether you actually launched an investigation to find out whether these pens or some of them at least were faulty, because like I said, by the time that I had arrived at the IEC Centre in Pretoria, that mark on my finger was no longer there. So I think also what worries me, and I think the previous speakers have spoken about it, you've listed the challenges. So the challenges are very clear. The pens were faulty, the Section 24A forms ran out, the zip machine was not able to pick up that people had voted twice or thrice. But now the challenge is that you list these also in the context of your budgetary constraints. And then you also now say a next challenge will be that the issue of, you know, the addresses that need to be collected. So my real concern is you've just said that you are already in the phase of planning for 2021, but what immediate measures are you going to put in place in the context of the fact that you don't have money or you've got budget constraints to address these issues? Because I would agree with the view that says if we don't address these issues quite urgently and ferociously, then the next election, the 2021 election, will be chaotic. I mean, I've attended many elections, and I must say, to sit at the IEC Centre this time around, I think the description to say it was a disruptive election, it was actually a bit of a chaotic scenes at the IEC. You know, you weren't communicating properly with the media at times when people were asking about, double voting, many of these conferences. So there was also a gap in communication, which I think also heightened the tensions in terms of people's fears. So basically, are you putting in place a plan to mitigate all these challenges that you've put up? Because I just see a slide that says these are the key challenges, but not really saying how you address these. I also wanted to know what additional funding and capacity would you need to implement the Political Party Funding Act? And also, in terms of your planning going ahead, are there any plans to ensure that you get a clean audit instead of an unqualified audit going forward? Thank you.
Yeah. Any other hand, members? I'll allow the IEC to give responses, but I'm happy that Lizelle or attended some of the elections that we have attended elsewhere, both in the continent and in the world. I'm sure members will be encouraged, and we will indeed make sure that members, at least of this portfolio committee, attend those elections, because once you attend some of those, you start to appreciate the kind of country we're living in and so on and so forth. But it's fine. I see. Can we get the responses?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, honorable members. I will ask the team to deal with specific questions, and I will round up in the event where there are some questions that are not answered. But before I start with the acting chief electoral officer, perhaps there's a context to dealing with some of the questions that have been raised. And I'd like to indicate that, you know, there is no single election that's like the other. They're very complex and very difficult. And we learn out of those, and I think we accept that there have been challenges. The acting chief electoral officer said they were disruptive in some ways. But I think it is important also to point out that we acknowledge the assistance rendered to our processes by political parties. And the open engagement where we shared openly with political parties the challenges as they came, and out of those consultations, the end result that we came to. Perceptions in an election are very critical and very important. And there are a number of perceptions we are dealing with here. We are not going to run away from them. We will face them and deal with them accurately and to the extent that we need to deal with them. The first one is the issue of double voting. The Commission stays or remains open. We have made that call. We remained with that call. We have not denied that numerous of the measures we have put into place to deal with these issues may have been breached, and we wanted to understand that. We have followed every lead, and I want to say, Honorable Pambo, that the issues you have raised yourself with us, you know we have followed, as we have done with other political parties, to get to the root cause of these matters. To this day, there are a number of court cases in the courts. There has not been a conviction made on anyone that has voted twice. The Commission said, to the extent that that may have happened, we would want to admit that. We will make everybody know what we have found and how we are dealing with it. So I just want to assure the members that, you know, the issues you raise with us, we do take seriously. We have looked, as we have clearly indicated, at as part of the assurance process in these elections, on materiality, on to what extent was this election affected by Section 24A, as was properly pointed out. And this is what I'd really want to lead the discussion before we answer the question. One is, we will come to this committee with respect to Section 24A. Section 24A cannot remain in the manner that it is. It is very difficult, and in the context of smart card IDs, in the context of persons that are looking at ways to affect an election improperly, we are going to be vigilant, and we will be coming to this House to amend, to propose amendments to Section 24A. We will. And perhaps that's one of the things that honorable members are raising. In relation to the zip-zip, we have indicated that the zip-zip was never intended initially to do this, but we have an opportunity now to replace the zip-zip, and we have indicated that in the process of doing so, in this plan, we are looking at a voter registration device that can, amongst others, look at real-time updating the process of voters coming to the voting station. One of the perceptions that we unfortunately have to deal with was that the zip-zip was keeping a record of the people that were voting and you know, telling other zip-zips this person has come. No, that is not so. The current zip-zip does not update the database immediately. We are looking at that as a replacement, and those issues are very important for us to deal with. The last issue that I wanted to deal with was the issue that Ntate Magluwa raised on the decision of Cabinet. And I don't know what Cabinet has dealt with, but I just wanted to share what has happened in the past. In the past, because of the nature of local government elections and the multiplicity of incidences it attracts, we have found it important or useful to us to have rapid action taken, and we have made that known to government, and government has reacted in some ways by establishing this. It's not completely how we you know, whether we say this or not. The point I'm making is that for members, it is important to note that we are going into an election that is where demarcation would have, redetermination of demarcation would have taken place, and a lot of communities may be raising issues with it. And for that, many of the responses don't lie with us. We would want to hold those that have the opportunity to resolve those, to resolve them as soon as is possible. In local government elections, the issue of the constituency boundary is the most sensitive thing that we need to address. We need to deal with that. The chairperson has indicated that this is an election, unlike the election we come from, where over 8 million households, of the 15 million, almost 8 million of those households would not have a conventional address. And that is an area of work. We would want those that are in government who deal with issues of address, or who are supposed to deal with issues of addresses, to assist and deal with those issues, so that by the time we come and do the work that we need to do, we are clear about the challenges cut out for us. I'm going to let the acting chief electoral officer to deal with those issues. I have noted the issues. In the event that there are some that are left, I will reallocate chairperson, and we will deal with as may be appropriate. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Let's start with the issue of teachers as electoral staff. That was true at some point in our history. At some point, it's no longer accurate. In fact, for these elections, 72% of those people who worked at voting stations were unemployed. Over 65% were persons who were younger than the age of 35. So we are alive to the challenges of unemployment. But we must also then balance that with the requisite maturity that is required of a presiding officer to manage difficult proceedings at a voting station. And we accept, we're looking at, the brief has also told us, confirmed this, that we must look at social media for our training, but also to attract young persons. But before we get onto the bandwagon and label young persons, our research has told us one thing, that once registered, young persons are more likely to vote than any age cohort. So the challenge that confronts us is, how do we remove barriers to registration to facilitate the participation of young persons? From far from labeling young persons, we're looking internally at ourselves to say, what other measures can we do to make it easier for them to apply for registration? We will be piloting a few studies this year that are based on an app, so that we can register them where they congregate, we can interact with them in media platforms that they use. The voters' roll, we compare on a monthly basis against the population register, so that we then remove people who are deceased or people who are not South African citizens, or to enroll those persons who at the point of registration may not have been citizens but have in the intervening period acquired the status of citizens. Commissioner Mepa, I think, has dealt with this adequately. We have already begun discussions with National Treasury on the plans that we have. We have a device, we're finalizing the specs, we are dealing with National Treasury, we have an indicative cost price, we are dealing with National Treasury on the funding shortfall. We have a follow-up meeting on the 17th precisely to deal with the issue of a device that will replace the ZipZip and that will do the twin requirement, which is to register voters correctly, but to also provide real-time live voters' roll on election day. We know that we can deploy this gadget, and it will remain connected with a combination of use of service providers in 95% of our voting stations. So we must find a solution for the residual 5% where connectivity is not possible, even if you use a combination of factors. By the end of this calendar year, we will come to the committee to sponsor legislative amendments to facilitate the improvements that are necessary to be done for these elections. The issues of Indelible Ink and the issues related to the safeguards, those ones become irrelevant if we can get a live voters' roll. So we've drawn a line in the sand. We're moving we're moving forward. Political Party Funding Act, we have, CFO, correct me, we have funding for the next 2 years. We have funding for the next 2 years. We will be publishing a notice for calling on interested parties who want to make oral submissions at public hearings that will be convened to give us indication. And as soon as we've done that, the Commission will finalize the resolution and determine a date on which the Act will be brought into operation. And my apologies to the committee. We did not understand the briefing session to be a debrief from the elections. Otherwise, we'd have prepared in that fashion. We understood this to be a technical presentation of the strategic plan and APPs for the current financial year. But as I indicated, we've concluded the internal debrief. We will have occasion to debrief with all political parties, so that we could also take on board the observations from political parties. Let me just caution, without being defensive, that an election is a complex activity, 22,000 voting stations. So we must always have proper perceptions that an incident or incidents that occurred in 70 or so voting stations doesn't characterize the entire election as though it was flawed and those type of things. However, we plan for a fault-free election. CFO, can you deal with the question of clean audit versus unqualified audit?
Thank you, CCO. I think most importantly, a clean audit is very close to the heart of the IEC. And I must highlight that the audit currently is not complete. But if we look back to the prior years, all the issues that were raised, we actually set up an action plan and we monitored it and we made sure that we don't have recurring findings. And where we saw that there was processes that had deficiency, we went back and we actually put systems and policies in place to ensure that we don't have recurring findings. I think we'll be able to give feedback on the outcome of the audit when we come back again.
Okay, last point was related to the ward demarcation. There are a number of dependencies. What triggers ward demarcation at the instance of the MDB is the minister first publishing formulae in terms of which the MECs will determine the number of councillors for each of the municipalities in their provinces. The minister will issue the formulae imminently. Thereafter, the MECs will apply the formulae to determine the number of councillors for each of the municipalities, and the MDB will then demarcate the number of wards, because in terms of the law, half of the councillors in a municipal council must represent wards. So there will be an occasion after the MDB has handed the wards back to us in August next year that will go into communities affected by those ward demarcations, so that we could reconfigure the boundaries of our voting districts to account for new ward changes. But we require the MDB to also communicate their decisions once they've made those decisions. It can't be that community only know about the impact of the decision of the MDB when we do the technical alignment of voting district boundaries. And for those voting stations that are on private property, the consideration there, the preeminent consideration, is convenience to a voter. It is so that in some localities, the only facility that is available that is convenient to the voter, i.e. in terms of time taken to access that voting station, but also the amenities that facilitate voting, chances are it's just a private property. We will default to a private property. But the majority of our voting stations are public amenities, schools, community halls, and those type of things. So also location helps. If you find a voting station that strangers voting ward boundaries, you create problems of people voting across their ward boundaries. But we liaise with local party liaison committees on the choice and selection of voting district boundaries. So I think it might just be useful that at a local level, our party reps there are alive to engage with us on the choices that we will make after that MDB has handed over the ward boundaries to us.
Dr. Mip, go on.
Chairperson, I'd like to deal with a few issues that I think were not covered. In relation to the issue of security and the bridges to security that we have experienced, there were sheer criminal events that we have reported to the police, but there were also coordinated instances that you know, the security structures are dealing with. When we organize elections, we do work with the security structures of the nation, and you know, they do give us feedback on what measures they are taking. It does seem like in very few isolated instances we did have continued disruptions, particularly after voting had taken place. But the security structures are dealing with this matter, and we are happy with the feedback that we are receiving from them. Dealing with staff fatigue, these are issues that my the acting CEO has indicated we are going to a debrief. Political parties are going to sit in there, and we will emerge with issues that we would be dealing with. The issue with respect to the CAM court order, I'm very pleased to say that we have fully dealt with that issue. In the last elections, we have amended the law to provide for the opportunity for political parties or any other citizen to raise objections to a person. And we have a date by which those objections must be received, a date by which they must be adjudicated, and a date by which publications are made. And if there are court decisions that have to be had, they would be. The elections coming will have that taken into account completely. So we have fully dealt with that issue. The issue in dealing with the filling of vacancies, why not 100% of those? I think it has been made clear that there are some limitations that we'd have to deal with, but this is the minimum that we're willing to deal with. The target with respect to voter education, we did not bring the figure here, unless Masiho, you have the number, but we can clearly. No. They were saying for the last elections, if I understood that. Yeah. We'll deal with that. We can. Let's not guess. This is Parliament. We're going to give them the correct figure, which they require of us. The Chairperson, I have raised this issue, but I did note the question that why did the scanner not pick people that have voted twice? I am saying for the record that I'm not, as we speak, the Commission is not aware of any single person that has been convicted of that, nor did we find any person that has done that. We are not saying it did not happen. We are inviting, because we are really keen to deal with that aspect, and I just wanted to deal with that issue. There was an issue about private property. Yes, there are a number of instances. There are not many where there are gated communities and so on and so forth, and there are stations situated in there. Farms, for example, as well, do give us challenges. We share this on an ongoing basis with political parties, but we are the first to go to those landlords and inform them if they are not complying with the requirements of the law. Because to the extent that elections must be held, there are provisions that bind even private landowners to the extent that we voters and or members of staff and political parties need to attend to those. That will be an area we will always deal with. We will not shy away from that. There was an issue raised about plans going forward with the IEC, and I think Masiho has dealt with it, Honorable Pambo. We are aware, and we are grateful. I must say, we are grateful for the engagement we have with political parties. That we have engagement doesn't make it an issue we walk away lightly. We are grateful for that help, but we will retain the openness and accountability as we develop and deal with the debriefing. The last issue was in relation to the measures on Section 24A and other challenges with inks and things. I think in the election that we are going to in 2021, there is no equivalent of a Section 24A. So that we say to the House, we do not foresee the challenges that we had in relation to Section 24A in the national and provincial elections. And to the extent that we now need to deal with we are dealing with the issue of ink, that issue will be put to bed. There are discussions going on. There is work that has been commissioned, and we will share to the extent that it's required, share the outcomes with this portfolio committee. I think we have touched on the issues that I am aware of. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you. Can we give Honourable Minister this chance to be the last person to interact?
Yes, Chairperson, thank you very much. I actually want to interact only on one issue because it surprised me, the question by Honourable McClure, because it looks like he has got suspicions about the Interministerial Committee. Sometimes we call it Interim Municipal Elections Committee or something like that. I'm surprised because it's not for the first time that I belong to such a committee. Over the past 25 years, in Limpopo, I used to be the MEC for Education. We used to form such a committee in the provincial cabinet because there are lots of things that the IC will need that facilitate election, that need that type of a thing. Number one, the IEC, in order to run free and fair elections, needs citizens to have IDs, and they are issued by us as Home Affairs. We can't frustrate elections by just not doing our work as Home Affairs, and so the Interministerial Committee would like to look into those issues when the IEC presents them and say, Minister Home Affairs, why are you not presenting IEC with what they want? The IEC needs infrastructure. For instance, I'm not sure whether parties are aware. We're not happy about elections taking place in a field somewhere in a tent. You know, IEC need to be, honestly, the elections taking place in tents have been very problematic. We would like to sit and say, can't we provide proper infrastructure for them to happen? IEC cannot provide elections, for instance, if they run out of electricity, and they can't provide it for themselves. But you also know they need stability. Elections need stability. It has been mentioned here about civil war and all that. And so they need security forces. You need the police to sit and see if they provide such a security. Now, lastly, you have just spoken about the budget, that political parties are not happy. They want the new equipment. You have presented to Treasury. Yeah, Treasury might say, no, there's no money. We've exhausted all the budget. Then the Interministerial Committee will have to sit and say, this is very important for elections, for democracy, and for fairness. And then we'll decide which part of the country's budget can we look into in order to help the IEC get what they want. So this is very important. For instance, the reason that I belong to that committee many times, in my province of Limpopo, most of the voting stations were schools. If you go back to 1994, many of them had no water, many had no electricity. We had to sit in that ministerial committee, call the IEC, Chief Provincial Electoral Officer, to tell us that there are 2,000 schools with no water, no electricity, and we must provide that. Or the IEC choose a particular area where they think there must be a water station, and there's no road to that place. There's no road, there's no way to reach that place. Then it is this committee that will solve that thing. So the committee at all will not interfere with the independence of the IEC, but is there to facilitate and they give the IEC what they are asking for. That's all that the committee exists for.
Yeah, thank you. I see your hand. I do not intend to open the... Because initially we had already closed, but I can give a benefit of doubt, provided you are not going to be just responding to. You'll be giving us more...
Yeah, thank you, Chair. There's nothing wrong with the IMC, Ministerial Committee.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with asking questions on the mandate. I think that is what I'm doing in terms of my oversight. If I can be explained the mandate as the minister or right now, then we understand. And we understand, I come from a province it has been under administration. There was an interministerial committee. There was no references given to us. There were no reports that we've seen. So we're asking these things to interact. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no, thank you. Can we have the government printing works coming? Let's break for 5 minutes just for tea. Then we proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, members. We are proceeding. Over to you.
Good afternoon. I'll be doing the presentation for the Government Printing Works Annual Performance Plan as well as the budget. Just one slide that I would like to present as a background. The GPW is a government component. We report to the Minister of Home Affairs and Oversight from the Portfolio Committee. We were established in 1888, which is just over 130 years in government security experience. We provide printing services to organs of state, so government is our customer. Since 2013, we've been self-funded, meaning that we do not get any funding from the fiscus or national treasury. We have three core services. It's your security printing, and an example of that would be your passport, ID, examination papers. Then we have non-security printing or commercial printing, which could be annual reports, brochures, posters. And then lastly, we are responsible for the publishing of the Government Gazette. That is the third core service. I will then get into the crux of the APP. We have four branches as GPW. Four branches. We've got the Office of the CEO that includes ICT and internal audit. We've got finance and supply chain, HR, strategic management, and then the core branch being production and operations. In terms of the Office of the CEO, under ICT, our first target is to ensure that 100% of security vulnerabilities detected by security assessments have been mitigated. And with that, we have a quarterly target that said we must apply all Microsoft patches as they are released, so 100% of those patches must be applied. The second target for ICT is a 99.5% system availability. It's on page 12, or slide 12. Of okay. and that is a quarterly target as well. And then the last target for ICT is 80% of identified ICT service offerings implemented. The reason we did not put it at 100% is there's still a dependency on CETA to provide certain support for us in this regard. So we made a provision of 20% for any delays in possibly attaining that target. But we are planning to do 100%, but we just factored in the 20% as a mitigating factor should CETA not assist us timeously. Under internal audits, we said that they should do 100% of their audits. Their audits get approved by the audit committee annually, so we said for the year they should achieve 100%, and we've broken it down to 20% in quarter one, 25% quarter two, 25% quarter three, and then 30% quarter four. Then we've got production and operations. This is our core branch as GPW. What we said here is that they should meet client specifications 100% for identity documents, and it should conform to the client specifications. The second target is similar, to say for travel documentations delivered that it must conform 100% to client specifications. The third target deals with examination scripts, which is a similar target, but it's just a different category of services that we offer, that it should conform 100% to client specifications. The Government Gazette, our target is that 100% of Government Gazettes published should conform to client specifications. The fifth one is a new target. We did not have it in the past, as we did not print security certificates. So for the year 1920, we put the target at 93% of high security certificates delivered to client specifications. Strategic management includes a number of divisions. The first one is marketing and strategy. As part of GPW, we try to engage as many customers locally as well as internationally. Currently, what we are saying is we should target at least or engage at least 20 local customers, and we've broken it further down per quarter to say quarter one, we should look at Department of Transport, Labor, and the Police Service, quarter two, three, and four. So the 20 targets we've broken down. Then the second part of that target is the SADC. What we plan to do is to engage seven countries. Today we are signing an SRA with Swaziland for the printing of the education certificates. And then, as Minister said earlier, we are engaging with Namibia on certain face value documents that they also want to print, that they want us to print. The second unit under strategic management is security. Which is security. So we said that we should implement the GPW security model, reviewed and implemented. The security policy procedures developed, so we've broken it down into quarter. Quarter one is your firearm policy and procedure, quarter two, control room, quarter three, document security, and then quarter four being your information security policy and procedure. Under risk management, we said that we must develop and implement a business continuity plan. And we've further broken it down into four targets for the year. The sixth target under strategic management says that top six strategic risks monitored against mitigation plans. So we've got a risk register, which we've broken down into certain actions that have to be taken, and that is monitored through the risk committee, which is an independent committee providing oversight on risk management. The branch financial services, currently the audit is underway. The reason we have not obtained a clean audit is because of irregular expenditure that was incurred in 2015-16 financial year, and we are still planning on getting an clean audit opinion going forward, but the dependency would be the condemnation of that irregular expenditure. Other than that, we did not have any audit issues. We also said that because we are self-funded, we must ensure that we remain sustainable, financially sustainable. And what we said is that we should have a 3 positive working capital ratio. That basically means for every 1 rand of creditors we have, we should have 3 debtors so that we remain liquid and our cash flow is monitored. We also said, and it's also reflected in the budget later on, is that to measure our profitability, we should at least make a profit of 10% of revenue. And we've exceeded this target over the last 3 financial years, but I will speak to the reason for the difference later on when I discuss the budget and the actual performance. And then the 4th target under financial services, we've got a head office that we bought in 2015, and we are in the process of refurbishing it to meet our requirements instead in terms of a head office building or administrative building, and that we hope to complete by end of this financial year. Then the 5th target is a target that is driven by the Department of Public Works. We measure it annually instead of quarterly, and it's basically 35% of the spending against the budget that monitors that target. In terms of HR, we said that we should have a GPW organizational structure submitted. The reason we put it over 3 years is that there's dependencies on other ministries in getting the approval. We could achieve it in 2 years, but worst case scenario, we said it would be fully implemented on the 3rd year. 90% of identified vacant positions filled, and we've broken it down per quarter, 20% in quarter 1, 30 quarter 2, 30 quarter 3, and then 10% quarter 4. With regards to the workforce, we have a training budget, and in terms of the budget, we have budgeted 50% of workforce trained, and the training is focusing on technical skills, meaning your people that are running the machine. And then secondly, supervisory experience, and then the rest is your normal training in terms of the performance management cycle. For the GPW, the year we just completed and the year that's under audit, we've made a surplus of 532 million. In the past 2 financial years, being in 17-18, of that 500,000, we've surrendered 300 million back to Treasury. And then in 16-17, out of the 591, we surrendered 100 million rand back to Treasury. So this year, once the audit is complete, we will then engage Treasury, and they will then determine how much they will be taking in terms of the profit that we've made post-audit. In terms of the budget, members will see that we've budgeted 10% of revenue as a profit. And the main reasons for the drop, if you compare the profit of 500 versus the profit of 153 million, there's a lot of capital expenditure that is only going to come through this year in terms of depreciation. Our Pavilion 3 plant, which Minister spoke to earlier, that has just been completed for the examination facility. It came on board during this year, so there will be leasehold improvement, depreciation charges. There's about 7 to 8 pieces of equipment that have now been commissioned, which was previously in boxes, so that depreciation is coming through. And also we will be ensuring that we fill 90% of all vacancies, so the employee costs will be coming through. So that is where the difference mainly lies in the actual performance versus the budgeted performance. Thank you.
Thank you. Members? Lizette? Yes, and then Makluwa will follow, and is your hand up? No, and then Honorable JJ, and then the whip will be the last. We can take them in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'll be as brief as the presentation was. It's very nice to meet an entity that doesn't take any money from Treasury but actually gives money back. It's like Christmas, come early. So I just wanted to ask quickly, in terms of staffing issues, why has the position of CEO been vacant for so long? I don't know if you answered that while I was out, sorry. I also wanted to know, do you print all the performance, annual performance documents of all government departments? Not. And why not? Okay. Because surely if you do government printing, it should be mandatory or, you know, compulsory that you do the printing of all departments within government, you know, all reports, because otherwise they might be able to outsource it for very expensive prices. So I just need to get some clarity on that. And then in terms of the 100% of client specifications for security documents and target 7.2.1, 7.2.4, does that include compliance with expected delivery times? And also with regards to your doing business with other countries in SADC, if you can give us an update on that.
Thank you, Chair. You know, when the presentation been made and the target of 20% of identified ICT offerings, I almost go bingo because if my memory serves me well, I heard that CETA was also mentioned. And Minister, we do have, through you, Chair, the same problem because there's quite a sound link between Home Affairs and CETA on the issues that we have. And we spoke earlier on the question of long lines and off lines and no lines and all of that. So I think this also rise for us, Chair, to an opportunity to have CETA sometime around the table and also for them to tell us what they do with this kind of two institutions in terms of their output. Then, because as stated that the ICT is to save information, to organize information, and to classify those. Now, I want to speak to the budget. 50% of the workforce are trained. If it's possible, that they can just explain ESW, and also there is a forecast on a decline in profit. What are the reasons for that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. Who determines the money that is submitted to Treasury? Is it yourselves, or does Treasury simply say we want this much, or is there a standing percentage of the profit that you must take back to them also? And the second question would be, you are dealing with, especially in terms of security, are all staff members vetted, or what's happening there? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, initially I could see the minister when he was commending the department. I think the government printing works, the good work that you are doing. One of the issues that I want to raise with you is in line with the SADC area of your involvement. What are the weaknesses that you may encounter as you liaise with the SADC in terms of your work that you are doing? And I think just to also up the question from Honorable JJ, the fiscal budget versus the Treasury regulations in terms of your interaction with them. If you don't make profit as the department, what are the measures that are employed by Treasury to the department?
Honorable Pambo? Okay, fine.
But one must never miss an opportunity to learn.
You'll follow Honorable JJ.
Okay. Go?
Yes.
Okay. Look, in perusing some of the pages that I did now, I see that there is a repetition of security across the pages. And with the sort of training that we, some of us, have been exposed to in literature, you know that there's something that you're doing with it. So I'm interested because I asked earlier the minister about the role of the banks in processing IDs, and I welcome his invitation that we must go and visit and see for ourselves how that happens. What would be your reading of it? What is your, or what would you, or how, what would you guys say about having an institution like, you know, banks involved? Also seeing that you are not funded by the Treasury. You know, in politics we always say that those who feed you in many ways, you know, control you. So in this case, you are not directly stifled or strengthened by government in relation to the purse, as far as I see that you're not funded by Treasury. So in that vein, I would like to hear what you would have to say about that. It's just to get a full sense. It's not something that perhaps I think has got a yes or no to it. It's basically a perception.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just forgot one more question. I'm reminded by my whip here. In dealing with especially, say, SADC countries, what happens if they default on payment? I'm just thinking about Zimbabwe can't pay Eskom, and then you print something for them and they can't pay you. What do you use there? Are they international or regional courts that controls that? Because if they are using our electricity and we have got load shedding here, you tend to think about it. You print for Namibia and they don't have money to pay. Maybe I was just thinking aloud.
Okay, over to you, Government Printing Works, Acting CEO.
Yeah. Thank you, and my colleagues will answer as well. We do not print for the whole of government. There's no regulation like in other entities which forces government to print with us. So if they come today, they come. Tomorrow they don't come. There's nothing that forces that to us, for them to print with us. So in some cases we printed APPs that was tabled last week. In other cases they did not come to us at all. In terms of the Treasury, there's a regulation in the Treasury regulations that says that all the profit an entity makes, it belongs to the shareholder, being National Treasury. So we declare to Treasury, like in this case, we would end of July go to Treasury and say, we've made 500 million profit. Out of that 500 million, we've committed X amount. We are willing to give you X amount. But they can come back and say, instead of giving us 100, we want 200. So there's no, they are the final sayer in terms of what, do we retain the profit or do we release it back to them. And it's part of the Treasury regulations. In terms of the vetting of staff, we have an SLA with State Security in terms of vetting of staff. There has been a delay in it, but there is a project manager specifically assigned to GPW. So as staff comes in, then we do the vetting. I do not have the specific numbers, but we will gladly provide that back to the committee. In terms of the SADC and the weaknesses that we encounter in engaging them, firstly, it's they have already got contracts with other service providers, and it's for evergreen contracts. So that's why the engagements like we had with Swaziland today, it's on certificates for the FET colleges. We've engaged them on passport and ID, but they've got contracts with Europe and whichever country, which is very difficult to get out of. But we are still pursuing that. I think Jim, the CEO, and Kube.
Good afternoon. I would respond to the question on the staffing issue in connection with the position of the CEO. The position has been vacant since May 2017, and we had advertised the position before. Unfortunately, with the continuous changes in ministry, we never got to a point where we see the process to finality. It was only last year where we attempted to see the process to finality, where we even had the interview. But unfortunately, Minister of Public Service Administration withdrew the process to say there are other internal processes that need to take place between ministry before we are even granted the approval to go ahead with the process. So now we are at a point where we're going to restart the process, advertise, and recruit.
Yeah. Before you, Minister, you want to answer?
Sure. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Members, in terms of the question of do our targets include service delivery times or turnaround times as we refer it, we used to in the past, prior to 2015, each one of our core business products were measured in three facets, in line with best practice of manufacturing, world-class manufacturing. That would be quality, the physical product quality, the speed, you know, service delivery, and the cost. We normally measure waste or cost of product for that. You always have to choose one that is the primary. For an organization, a corporate organization, they normally would choose probably cost and some speed in certain instances. However, we chose quality given the fact that a defect in a passport does not just affect one passport. It affects the reputation of the entire country's passport range completely. And we could have international regulations and international reputational damage if one passport is seen as defective and a South African is arrested abroad. And that could have far-reaching impacts in terms of our diplomatic relations and diplomatic expectations for the future. So the product quality cannot be looked at as just a manufacturing product quality, a simple aspect. We subscribe to a Six Sigma expectation and lean manufacturing expectation, so quality is number one. We were advised by National Treasury as well as the Department of DPME and Monitoring and Evaluation at that stage to allow the two other measures to be in part of our operational plan instead of our performance plan and make sure quality is number one. So we still measure turnaround times, and that turnaround time is submissive to the Department of Home Affairs' overall turnaround strategy. So we support the Department of Home Affairs' overall 13-day turnaround expectation for documents in our portion. So it's never lost in our measure. So, but the measure that you see on our APP are primarily related to the quality of the product in its performance and its function as a security document or high security document. The second aspect is Honourable Members' comment about security or the request on security being a thin line through it. It's true. It is our ethos. It's in our genetic strand as an organization. Security is our core. We would not have any mandate if we're not producing a secure document or being the security printer in the country. It's our reliance. We are quite comfortable that we sit on the Modernization Steering Committee. We are influenced for Department of Home Affairs, so we are involved in the security design and architecture of systems and processes. And we are confident that the manner in which it has been developed supports the country's expectation of a secure document without any outside influence in the process. That's our view. In terms of the opinion on the banks and other service providers, the banks are, we still also maintain the same standpoint. We are confident that the banks are mere landlords. They provide a space, electricity, and a line, and everything else the department has oversight over completely. And there's never been any concerns in terms of the architecture for our passports and IDs and high security documents. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, there's a question, or there's a correction that I need to make. In my ratio of profitability or sustainability, I said that it should be 3 times debtors. It should be, for one creditor that we have, there should, or one liability, that one rand's worth of liability we have, we should have at least 3 times the assets. I said debtors, but it should be assets. So I just wanted to correct that. Also, on the bank's issue, we are just the printer of the passport, of the ID document and the passport. The policy lies with the Department of Home Affairs on that. Then there was the issue of saying 50% trained. The WSP is the work skills plan that gets submitted to Department of Labor annually. So in terms of our budget, we said that we will spend 50% of, we will do 50% training in terms of the WSP. Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll give it to you after you all give it to the minister. But I want the minister to talk to the matter in terms of how do we progressively make sure that almost all government departments use the government printing works, because I think that can minimize spending, because if they are using other service providers, it may be high cost, as opposed to them coming here. It may even assist the treasurer, because they will even make more money that goes back to the coffers. So let's take you, Makruva,
yeah,
and Honorable Lizal, then the minister.
Thank you, Chair. I want to have a follow-up. The minister emphasized how safe is the smart ID card. It's very safe. I'm not canvas for GPW. So I want to ask, is it only them printing it? And then the other thing of what you are addressing now, on this juncture, then it's GPW printing for some stuff for us and then another department. So maybe I think we can peruse that one. Maybe the other side, if they are not printing, the other side, you know, the tenders and that thing called kickbacks, I don't know what, we must check on that. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chairperson, I've been covered by you. I wanted to say the same thing, that, you know, in this time when our economy is in crisis, it's sort of difficult to understand why departments would be using outside service providers at high costs when they can actually utilize a service that is already within government. So I think just to add on to what you said, it would be good if our minister could find a way, maybe through MOUs or engagements with other departments or a directive that Cabinet could give, that would be, you know, something that would assist Treasury. Because I mean, sometimes these annual reports are very glossy and they are very thick, so they must cost a lot of money to print them. So it would be better if we direct that work to this department or this entity. Thank you.
Honourable JJ, then Honourable Minister. I'm not sure whether the DM wants to say something before the minister. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I like what has just been said. And if we put it as a principle, none of the MPs must use British Airways.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, Honorable Magi, I'm one of the people who was very committed to SAA, particularly because of the Voyager. But it doesn't work. Sometimes it's just not there. What do you do? It's not there most of the time. Things have changed, but anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I know what you're talking about, because that's the main issue I raised my hand for, Chairperson. You are right. When I visited government printing works, that was my first question. I'm confessing, really. I've been in government for many, many years. And in the Department of Health, I used to pass one of the areas of government printing works. I used to believe it's just an area where they photostat or print government gazette. I was very pleasantly surprised when I visited the printing works. I think it's one arm of government that is working immaculately well and even making these profits. And my first question is, why are government departments not printing here? As she said, there are three types of things they do there. They can print brochures, they can print government gazette, they can, you know, but they also do high security printing. And high security printing is not only passports and certificates and ID. They can also print question papers. When I was there, I found mathematics question papers being printed. And I got very scared because I was in education. There was always this hullabaloo about question papers leaking. And so I was interested in security features. And they showed me security I've never seen before. Why? And they told me, if there's any leak of a question paper, it's not going to happen here. And I say, show me. They showed me cameras all over the place, and everywhere where, you know, right on the roof where you have got to destroy them or shoot them before you change anything. They showed me the security features. That's why I'm inviting the committee, because I don't want to talk on your behalf. I want you to see there. So my first question was, why can't all the government question papers be printed there? So when I asked that day, it was four provinces, right? Yes, I found question papers being printed for Limpopo, Free State, Northwest, yes, and Northern Cape, yes. But there are five provinces. So my first question was, the biggest examination papers is in Gauteng. So I went to see MEC Lesufu immediately. Why are you not printing there? There are only four provinces. And he said, at some stage they tried, but there was a problem of capacity. I said, I want you to come and see. I've got an appointment with him, because I want the whole of Gauteng to print there, as the whole of Western Cape and Gauteng. Those are huge government departments. Then I found that all the FET college question papers are printed here, all of them. Then I question about certificates. They claim, at least that's a claim because I haven't proven it, they claim their certificates are more secure than certificates printed by universities. And so my question is, why can't we also talk to universities to go and print them? Because they showed me why they say printing a certificate there, it's not going to be easy for anybody to forge it. And they showed me the features also. And so that's why I'm very happy that I'm going to go from department. I've already approached two ministers and questioned them, why are you not printing there? Because it's not only an issue of saving money. It's also an issue of job creation, by the way. They haven't shown you in the slide there. After paying all the 500 people without any cent from Treasury, they pay a staff of 500. This year they are going to hire 150 more using the same money, no cent from Treasury, and buy equipment worth R500 million, and then still take a profit of 153 million rand to Treasury. There's no government entity that works like that. That I know of. I even jokingly said maybe we must bring in SAA to go and spend some months there and see how things are done. I know these are different operations, but I once said so. So if then all government department prints there, they will then expand and hire more people. And that will create jobs, especially for our young people. The 150 jobs they are going to advertise is artisans. Ne? Yes, can you imagine the young people who are artisans around the country who have got jobs, who will certainly do so. Now, the same as SADC, and it actually embarrasses me. I told you I've already been to Namibia. They are already doing it, but I believe it's my job. Yes. I've already got an appointment with Swaziland. Now, I can't be running around our neighbors
asking them to come and print here when government departments are also not even using us. Then there was a question from Honorable Maki. What if the countries don't pay? That will be a sad day. Because why should they pay countries in Europe? Yes. In quite our many of our neighboring countries, when you want a passport, you go to Europe. That's where the passport get printed. And they are paying. So if now the printer even ask, then why do we call ourselves SADC and AU if all of us still depend on our colonial powers for our civic matters? Surely they must do it at home. And many of them are agreeing with us. What is left is to write a memorandum of understanding. And now to come and not pay us when they've never owed Europe, that would be very sad for the whole of Africa. So, yeah, there was a question about CETA and the, yeah, which I mentioned. Look, Honorable McClure, I'm one of the ministers who believe the CETA Act must be changed. Because I meet it everywhere. I told you this morning, when you go to education, they'll tell you broadband CETA. You go to why clinics are not connected, why can't you use the health information system, broadband CETA. You come to government printing with broadband CETA. You go to home affairs offices, why they're always offline, broadband CETA. You meet it everywhere, and that's why I call it an elephant in the room. And when you ask, they say that act compels us to go through CETA, even when you know where you could go. Surely it must change. Otherwise, you are not going to be able to move. The profits, they are not declining profits. It's only that they don't have the same profit every year because, as he tells you, there's no constant customers except Home Affairs itself. We are, because they print our IDs, we have to pay. So we are the only ones. The other department come and go. And so not every year do they make the same amount. And that's why, yeah, that's number one. Number two, you realize that they are saying 500 rand profit, but this year 153. Because they are capitalizing. When I was there, they were installing equipment bought from, was it Europe, that printing machine, worth 80 million. You know, so they are buying half a billion rand worth of equipment, and that's taken from the total amount, and it's then that they declare profit. So they are not declining, they are just not similar year in and year out because they don't have that clientele base that is stable. The other question is again about banks, and unfortunately, they've answered it. They don't make policy. We are the ones who make policy. They just print. But there was a question whether they are the only one, Honorable McClure, who print. Yes. No other entity, public or private or whatever, within the borders of the Republic of South Africa can print an ID. Only them. Yes. No other entity can print the passport. Only them. So, and the security features are there with them only yeah. I nearly said something that may make the media start getting excited about the capacity which I think they have, but we'll give it to you there beyond what I've already explained, because that's a bit sensitive.
Yeah.
But when you are there, you'll see it on your own and we can be able to explain to you exactly what you're talking about. But this is an entity that I really respect, I must tell you. And I'm promising that in the next input, when we come here, if government departments can play ball, I can show you the number of young people who suddenly get jobs there through the government printing works. It has got enormous capacity to do a great change. By the way, this is a government entity reporting to public works. The appointment you're talking about, the CEO, is going to be done by, not public works, man. Home Affairs. Sorry, I withdraw. It's going to be done by the Minister of Home Affairs. There was an attempt to turn it into an SOE. And for obvious reasons, that attempt was thwarted, even by the Department of Public Service and Administration. So they don't have a board. All this work is not done by a board or what. They've got no board. They've got the CEO, CFO, chief directors, etc., but they all report to the Department of Home Affairs. So it's a fully fledged Home Affairs entity. And I personally am happy that it should not be turned into an SOE because we might start having problems there. Yes.
Yeah, no. Thank you. Thank you, Minister. But my advice would be maybe we must approach the leader of government business because he can be able to coordinate all departments in terms of ensuring that all these departments do their annual performance and their printing works in the government printing works. I think that would be the correct way than to approach individual ministers. But members, we...
Chairperson, I'm very sorry, my apologies. I'm still going to examine because some of them hide behind PFMA. That PFMA says they must compete with other private entities in terms of the PFMA. And that I do have a problem with. That's why there are quite a number of people who say save on the corruption issues, but there are certain aspects of PFMA that needs to be relooked into. I don't know whether it's true, but many of them tell me that no. Why do you go there? They said, no, PFMA said I must advertise and compare them, and in terms of the comparison, that private company is one. I said, but why do you take money to a private company when you are going to expect them to give you profits back to Treasury, which will be distributed as a budget to you when you actually don't support them? It doesn't make sense. So I'll be happy, Chairperson, if the committee could also help me. Because then, and say, but why is the state behaving like this? Because then all government departments will come, will expand it. I can tell you, we'll show you bigger profits than we show you now.
Yeah, I've heard of that argument at the PFMA, but let's explore with the leader of government business and check properly this legislation. Members, we thought part of the one of the most important meetings we must have, which we thought we would put in the program, was to visit the department itself, go to government printing works, and go to the IEC offices, so that they take us through, so that when we contribute from this point, we at least have a high-level view of what is happening there. I think that will assist a lot. But, okay.
Just the last one from my side. You know, what Honorable JJ has said, I think as a committee we must also guard against dictating, you know, for some of the departments what to do and what not to do. Because at the end of the day, we also can't threat small business out there in terms of their work that they are doing for government. So I think we must be a little bit cautious on that one.
Okay. We could do without raising that input, but it's fine. Because I was explaining something very, very serious, that we need to visit these three. So we're looking at dates. I have just circulated now the what we call a draft program for between now and when. So the reason why it was circulated, it was to request you, your good selves, to make inputs of what you think we can do. But we have done it in line with what is parliamentary program for the quarter. So I want us to approve that. I want us to approve that. But it is subject to changes, because even the parliamentary program changes on weekly basis. So I thought we could approve that as a program for now. And if we do, I'm sure as soon as it's practically possible, we'll have to start by visiting this the department itself, Honorable Minister, and DM, Government Printing Works, and the IEC offices, so that we acclimatize ourselves and make sure that even those members that I knew can fit in like they've been here all the time. So, any comments about the program we've circulated?
Chair, can you explain the program? I don't understand what's happening.
What? You want to explain it?
Members might be confused.
I'd be surprised by the short program, given the... But it's basically, there were supposed to be initially supposed to be 5 meetings for this term, but the plenaries around the budget have kind of basically are happening on the same day as often as our committee meetings are supposed to happen on Tuesdays. So a lot of those meetings have fallen away, and then the term has also been made 1 week shorter. So we were supposed to go on oversight in the last week, and that last week has now been converted to constituency week. So we actually at this stage only have 1 meeting available for the committee, and that's next week, Tuesday. So that will be on the 9th of July next week, and in that we'll be just looking at the legacy report, which is the outstanding issues or the overall report of the committee from the last 5 years, and then the consideration of a budget report based on today's proceedings, which we'll submit to members during this week for them to consider before debate or considering it next week. And then finally, the Parliament app is, we'll be getting a briefing on moving forward to the digital age, how we'll be working with electronic documents rather than paper documents, like the giant stacks that we saw today. We're going to be moving towards electronic documents, so we're getting briefing on that. So that's the proposal. And then the 10th of July is the budget debate. It's not a meeting of the committee, but rather in the plenary. Just put it down there because the members will know when that budget debate is happening.
Honorable Lizelle, Honorable Makua, you want to? Okay.
No, Chairperson, I wanted to ask, if we only deliberate on the budget vote report on Tuesday, are we within time, because normally, aren't we supposed to, is the report not supposed to be ATC before we, do we have enough time between finalizing the report, it being ATC, and us going for the debate? Okay. And also, secondly, are you then proposing the oversight visit to fall within the constituency week after the National Assembly period has finished? Or when do you want to do the oversight?
Yeah, thank you. I think with regard to the visit, because it's something very important, it will empower all of us, because almost all of us knew in the home affairs industry. If it does not happen the last time, that is provided the parliamentary program changes. If it does not, the first thing we do next when we come back, it will be to go to visit these three entities. And then on Tuesday, between now and Thursday, you will be circulated copies of a report of what we have dealt with today to make inputs and further discussions. And then on Tuesday, we'll look at the report and adopt it. Once we adopt it, then it can be ATC'd in the morning of, or in the afternoon of the same day, or in the morning of the debate. Then I think that will be that. Because the debate is at 2. Makluva?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I want to suggest that we accept the report as is, with the exception of on 9 July, that we also start 9:30. I also take it for granted that the legacy report was adopted by the Portfolio Committee of the 5th Parliament. I'm not sure, but I don't have a problem if we have to do so. And then also with the anticipation on the concern of it is not a lot of job, we must also bear in mind that a lot of members belongs to other clusters, so we have to go sit in that other budget votes, and that's why it looks like that. So it's actually not real that really that we're not going to have work, we are going to run around.
So you're suggesting that you started 9:30? Yes, I think that is acceptable, members?
Yeah.
It's acceptable. No, we may not have enough time, and members who belong to other committees may have other issues that they must attend to. And the following day is a debate, and on the very same day on Tuesday, the plenary would have started. So we are expected to do other things that relate to plenaries of other sector departments. And
if it is adopted, thank you very much. I would like to, on behalf of the members of the committee, Minister, to thank you and the Deputy Minister to attend until we finish the meeting. In other committees, the Minister will just come and sit for speak after that, off he is gone. So I think we're not taking that very light as the committee, that you sit the whole time and engage with the members. And we thank you very much, and the Deputy Minister. And to members, I think I would like to thank you again, once more. I think it's a good start for the meetings that are coming ahead. I think it is a good start. And we are looking forward in good cooperation and in ensuring that whatever we do, we put the interest of the public, South African public, number one, and we uphold the constitution as we've all taken the oath in front of the Chief Justice. The meeting stays adjourned. Thank you very much.
It's yours, yeah.